I came as a delegate member sent by an NGO in Montreal called Alternative. Personally, I can add that I came in myself because I wanted to try and do my part in taking some responsibility for the floor that I'm in part responsible for, being a member of the Jewish community, who in North America especially has had a really unfortunate tendency to support Israel unconditionally in its atrocities against Palestinians, and me being also a member of Western society who basically been funding what's going on here. So what I've seen so far is something that is hard to put into words. This morning, for example, I mean, I've had really long days, but I'll just start with today. This morning, we toured this one camp called Balata, and we just walked amongst the rubble, children in this rubble. It's sort of a mixture of kids playing and maybe a few of them trying to find some of their toys lost in their buried homes. And then there's women weeping because in the camp that we next to, that we visited, there were at least two people killed, including in one home that sat right next to a cemetery that had been set up there for all the Palestinians that had been killed in the camp before by Israelis. So I went into one home, and the living room of the family was totally demolished. The Israelis had come in and smashed the cabinets, smashed family pictures, smashed Holy Scripture that was on the wall. Down the block from the camp, there was a youth center, like a three-story youth center, where the children of the refugee camp would go, where their soccer teams would sort of meet, where there was a basketball court, where there were study groups and so forth. And we walked in, and the windows are smashed. The computers that kids use to do their homework, to be on the internet, to do basic kids stuff that all kids do, were smashed in. Rooms where they're playing were... rooms where they just play in were just demolished. There was graffiti on the wall. There was, in Hebrew, a slang, you know, like a slang term for Arabs. And just, it's beyond words. Open up the newspapers in Canada or the U.S. What Israel does, like what they did today in terms of, you know, smashing youth centers and bombing people's homes, that's called the retaliation to Palestinian terrorism. Whereas Palestinian terrorism, it may be terrorism, but that is always terrorism. And when Israel happens to go in simple, when Israel happens to target innocent civilians, that's called a retaliation. It's not a retaliation. It's terrorism. No. It's terrorism of the worst form. It's terrorism with gunships and helicopters and tanks against a defenseless, starving, miserable people that have been confined to these camps and whose plight is only being worsened by the continued attacks.
Aaron, just to catch listeners up to who you are and where you're speaking from right now, you are standing literally on a pile of rubble outside of Arafat's compound there in Ramallah. And we also have on the line with us Daniel, who's from a local organization called Palestinian and Jewish Unity here in Montreal. And I believe Daniel had a question for you.
Yeah, I was wondering, Aaron, have you had the opportunity to talk to any of the Israeli military people? Do they have any justification for what you see there?
My interaction with them has been more seeing them at checkpoints, which are set up outside every single Palestinian village or town, where Palestinians are made to wait in line for hours and hours and hours in the hot sun, where Palestinians are made fun of, they're pushed around. I've seen Palestinians being blindfolded, being made to sit on a rock for hours and hours and hours with their heads down. One guy that I met today in Nablus, in the refugee camp, mentioned how he was put down at a checkpoint and made to sit there for 7 hours with his head down, and then at some point was put in a room with other Palestinians. This kid was 17, and a soldier came in and had some bread and some jam, and he tossed it on the floor. He told them to all go at it and eat it with their teeth like dogs. So in terms of, I've asked Israelis whether they think this was a retaliation. I'm sure they think so. But again, this is from a people that has accepted or has basically, that has internalized an acceptance that it's unconscionable of a people for 35 years. So by the standards that they've created in terms of where it's okay to violate every single basic law in the world, to keep a stronghold over the territories. But by their logic, I don't. You know, of course, it makes sense to them that to bomb innocent civilians, to bomb refugee camps, is a form of defense. So I'm sure to them it is. But that's a matter of perception. Hitler, although I'm not comparing Hitler to the Israelis, I mean, obviously he was far, far worse. But to him, what he was doing was defense of Germany. So I mean, obviously one can make excuses and commit to oneself pretty easily. that what one is doing is in defense of the country. And I understand why, because I do know that the horrible suicide attacks, I mean, it's terrible to be an Israeli, too. I mean, I've lived in Israel before. I was walking in there a few days ago. People are scared. I don't blame them. But behind all this death are problems. And moreover, behind all this killing is responsibility. And the point is that there is no cemetery, not even near any cemetery, between the resistance of a oppressed and victimized people who are humiliated every single day, whose basic rights are violated every single day, whether it be at a checkpoint into their town that hinders their movement from place to place, whether it be from their work or to their house or to a relative's house in a nearby town, who are humiliated by having their squalid camps next to these built-up Israeli settlements funded by U.S. money that house the Israelis who have come in and who live in these lush communities with swimming pools and green lawns next to these chained-up camps where Palestinians who used to live in Israel have now been confined to. I mean, but there's no symmetry between these two, between one party that is the most sophisticated military in the Middle East, armed by the world, the biggest superpower, and aided with not just the military support of the U.S., but the intellectual support of people both in Canada and the U.S., as we all know, who have devoted themselves to completely denying these crimes and blaming them on the victims. There's no symmetry.
Aaron, you had brought up press coverage. I wonder, you probably haven't had a chance to read the Globe and Mail since you're there in the occupied territories, but the only image that comes to us in today's newspaper is the image of a victim of yesterday's bus bombing, and he's lying in his hospital bed. And my point in bringing up this image is that oftentimes when there is a suicide bombing, the media is close. It's right in there. It's got all the pictures. It's got interviews with the victims. But whenever there's a military incursion by the Israeli Defense Forces, the media is kept out and away from the front lines. As we saw with the siege on the Church of the Nativity, the media was at a distance, as we saw with the attacks in Jenin. So I wonder, you're standing right outside of Arafat's compound there in Ramallah, standing on the rubble. Could you describe the scene for us?
I'm outside Arafat's compound, which, again, as you know, was subjected to another siege today by the Israeli military. It's weird for me because I was here 2 nights ago, and I visited and I walked through and with some other people. And in fact, one of the guards gave us a little tour of what had gone on, and the destruction that we saw was bad enough. I mean, buildings had been destroyed, there was rubble everywhere. Arafat's car that had been a gift to him from Clinton, as one guard pointed out, had been destroyed. I mean, and I have to say this quietly because there are guards around, and I don't want to say this too loudly, but I'm not, you know, I don't want to come across as being too sympathetic to Arafat. I'm not at all, and I think he's done a lot of bad for his people. But the point is now, what I'm seeing now is coming back 2 days later, and seeing what they did this morning. It's just what I thought was bad on Tuesday or Monday, whenever it was I was here. I mean, it's unbelievable. There are buildings, so many buildings have just been destroyed, rubble everywhere. Water is shooting out. In between the two main complexes where, in fact, Arafat met with George Tenet from the CIA yesterday. I mean, things happen so fast here. In between his compound and where he meets with people like Tenet, there's this little bridge that I guess a tank or a helicopter came in and just blew it. So now there's this big hole. And now there's just a bunch of local Palestinians and there's Arafat security force walking around, and they're trying to figure out what to do. And if I was Arafat, I mean, again, he's not somebody who I have that much sympathy for over the years. I mean, I don't want to say that too loud, but I mean, at this point, I can't help but think, I mean, what can the guy do? If you believe what U.S. intelligence says, Arafat does not have that much control over the suicide bombers. The only truth that we've seen thus far has been in those documents that Israel sees that we're supposed to claim, all these links to which showed nothing. And so what they do is they keep on bombarding him, destroying not only the infrastructure of his own compound, but the infrastructure of the whole Palestinian Authority. So elsewhere in Ramallah, where the PA is located, there's all these different ministries that we've driven by that have been demolished. A really good illustration of what's going on now and what's been happening in Israel for 37 years. The Ministry of Housing is totally demolished. It's like the, or at least the lot that's for the Ministry of Housing, which is rubble. Maybe they moved it. But the point is, and that's exactly in tune with what Israel is doing now, and that's exactly in tune with what they've been doing for forever, is demolishing Palestinians' homes. As they bombard Arafat and they destroy his building, and at the same time they implore him to stop terrorism, well, what is the guy supposed to do? On the one hand, they bomb all of his infrastructure. They kill his men. They kill all of his men today. And they, ruin basically any chance that he may have, if he even has a chance of stopping suicide bombers. They will never, ever, because I'm Jewish myself, and I identify with Israel, and it's very dear to me. We will never have security as long as we continue to oppress other people. It's not just a matter that I can see from observing on the ground. It's an elementary fact that you are not going to achieve peace through victimizing and brutalizing people. You just will not. You will not.
For listeners who are just tuning in, we are talking with Aaron, who has left from Montreal last Friday, has been in the occupied territories since Sunday, has visited Arafat's compound, has been on the sites of some of the refugee camps that have bombarded there. Aaron had earlier in this year participated in a sit-in in Kotler's office here in Montreal. Folks might remember some press coverage from that action that you took back with other Jewish people from Montreal, but also Palestinians. And now we're speaking to Aaron in the occupied territories. He is right now standing outside of Arafat's compound, literally standing on the rubble from last night's actions. And Daniel is also on the line with us, who's a member of Palestinian and Jewish Unity, a group here in Montreal that holds weekly vigils out in front of the Israeli consulate, which is on the corner of René Lévesque and Peel, at noon on Fridays. And Daniel, you had another question for Aaron?
Yes, I did. I was wondering, Aaron, whether you've had the opportunity to get a reading of the reaction in the local Palestinian community. Sharon said early on when he began the offensive in April, they said, we need to make the Palestinians suffer so that they will accept peace on our terms. And so basically the idea was crush them down enough and they will bend to our demands. What is your feeling among the people that you see there?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I told everybody that I've met, or most Palestinians that I've met, what a privilege it's been for me to be able to meet them and see them in the struggle, because all of them, I mean, Sharon had it half right. They have suffered, and all of them have said that. People have said, it feels like I can't breathe. It feels like I'm dying. I can't breathe. I can't move. That's what I keep hearing, whether that's at checkpoints, or whether I'm speaking to a group of children who are trying to set up a community leadership program in Ramallah. All of them are saying the same thing. We're suffering. We can't breathe. We can't move. And people are saying, I'm depressed. I mean, I've never heard so many people say it in my life. I can't do justice. I can't put into words how much suffering I've seen. At the same time, though, all of them have all said that we will not stop our resistance. Sharon will not win. This is our land. We deserve our rights, our dignity, and they do. And it's been, I can't describe the privilege and the honor it's been for me to be able to be in their presence, because these are people that are dealing with some of the worst that humanity can offer. I mean, obviously there's worse, but these are people who do not have the freedom that, you know, all of us can enjoy in Canada, in the U.S., that they do not have, and they aren't having it under really harsh terms, under terms of strangulation where they can't move. If you're a Palestinian and you want to move from city to city, even for me who had a passport, you know, at some checkpoints, which are set up now, it's at every single Palestinian town, even for me, it was a while to wait, but for them, they're waiting, students on the way to school, people on the way to work, people who have been working in Israel for days who just want to get back to the families, but they've been kept on being sent back because the soldiers say, nope, sorry, you can't get through. The fact that these people can maintain, I mean, let alone the fact that they can continue to say that they want to resist and that they'll struggle, but the fact that they can still be nice and they can still make, I mean, like, people are telling jokes and people are thanking us for coming and they're saying how much they appreciate our support. I can't describe the privilege that I feel in being able to be in their presence. And so in terms of what this will do to their morale, it's made me crazy already. I mean, I feel crazy, and I have so many feelings and inclinations to want to actually, like, when I see Israeli soldiers. Now, you know, I want to shoot them too. The fact that they can maintain their morale, the fact that they can maintain their dignity and their courage, and their humanity.
Aaron, you've been, you know, telling your story of what you've seen on the ground and what's happening right now outside of Arafat's compound as you stand there in the rubble. But what's the message you want to convey to Canadians and other people here in North America who might hear you giving this report? What kind of action do you hope they commit to after listening to your words?
One thing that I am sure of now is that I see no hope in the parties here being able to resolve this crisis. The Palestinians obviously being the victims of the oppression, being the victims of the occupation, they're in no position to change the term. No matter what they do, they will not be able to, no matter how many concessions they make, no matter how much Arafat does, they will not be able to solve this problem. The Israelis who, I think, as I've experienced myself, having lived there, are intoxicated with the power they have, with the influence, with the support they've received from the U.S. And with the racism that's embedded in their society. Israel is a country that's officially the French state of the Jewish people, not of the citizens, but the Jewish people. But aside from that, there is, unfortunately, an acceptance of the racism and the colonialism that is essentially the occupation. So I see no hope. The only hope that I see is, I think it's been true for a long time now, it's in the area of the world whose crucial opinion and crucial support for this occupation, which I think is responsible for all this bloodshed. It's important where there is hope is basically in changing the opinion of people in the West and of informing them of the crimes that we are committing. And when I say we, I mean Canada, but to a much more, to a far larger degree, I mean the U.S., whose crucial military and diplomatic support has maintained this occupation for 35 years. If we can change that, if we can change the opinion of the public, if the people...
I think we've lost them.
I think so, too. I think he just cut out there.
Just to summarize, I think his point is well taken. You cannot really expect these two parties who've been warring so long to come to a peaceful solution, especially when there is an underlying ideology on the more powerful side to retain substantial amounts of land that simply make it impossible for the Palestinians to have a viable state. So I think it's important that aware people here in Canada and in the West generally put pressure on their democratically elected governments, denounce the occupation, and call for international military intervention to separate the sides. I think that this is really one of the most important things we can ask for. I was speaking to an Israeli activist recently, and this was the point he kept coming back to, that if we get the sides separated, then we can at least stop the killing and set the precedent of international input into the scene, as opposed to what the U.S. seems to prefer to push, which is negotiations between two grossly unequal parties.
Daniel, you represent here in town a group called PAJU,
yes.
One of the spokespersons for Palestinian and Jewish Unity, and you've done a lot of vigils since the inception of the group outside of the Israeli consulate. They happen every Friday at noon, and the Israeli consulate is located at René Lévesque and Peel. I wonder if you've had the opportunity to speak with people passing by, and has this issue come up of international intervention? Does anyone ever ask you the question, well, why is it that Canada is, you know, gung-ho to send troops to Afghanistan or Somalia, but why not Israel?
I think that's the sort of question that gets asked more by people there on the picket line in front of the embassy than by people passing by. I will say... I quite admire the politeness of our society. We get very little grief from people passing by. Most people are willing to accept the handouts. There are lots of expressions of sympathy. Frequently, the average passerby will come back to the refrain of, yes, but if they'd only stop the suicide bombings, which, of course, is one important component of this. But as Aaron pointed out, there is such a disproportion between the sides. There's such a coherent planning for the retention of mass amounts of Palestinian lands that more needs to be done than simply enforcing peace on one side. The occupation itself is a form of terribly brutal violence. There's been 35 years of gradual dispossession of the people. They've been reduced to living in Bantustans. And for those of the listeners who are not familiar with this issue in great depth, I'd like to point out that Desmond Tutu recently publicly denounced the occupation as being the equivalent of the apartheid suffering of the black people in South Africa. And he pointed to the level of violence as something that was almost unimaginable for him. So I think we need to try by peaceful means to do as much that is as effective as possible. Our governments tend to be very sensitive to feedback from their electors, from voters. By all means, call people like Jean Chrétien, Bill Graham, our secretary, our minister of foreign affairs. Denounce this in the strongest terms. Demand that Canada take a stand such as it took against apartheid, calling for an end to the oppression, calling for a just peace. And I'd like to invite your listeners to come by if they're not comfortable with joining a picket line or a demonstration. At least come by René Lévesque and Peel tomorrow on Friday between 12 and 1. Take a look at it. Speak to some of the people. See whether you can find it comfortable to stand with us. It's a demonstration that's probably the longest-running vigil in Montreal's history. We started back in February of 2001. We've never missed a Friday. It's a very powerful statement of the refusal to accept the injustice of the occupation. We believe that the occupation, Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, is one of the most fundamental causes of the ongoing violence. There's also a major demonstration coming up on Saturday. I think you have some details that you'd be able to pass on that.
Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks an awful lot.